We have so far arrived at a conception of a reality that is integral in its character, the aim and object of our endeavor. We have seen that the reality is not merely an impersonal silence or power or consciousness, nor is it a personality or a person familiarized to the human mind by religion, nor is it a state of being, but all of them together. The reality we seek is like this manifestation of which we are a part, a reality consisting of many aspects. As the reality is many-aspected, our approach to it is also many-limbed. We approach the divine not on one laid down, settled path, but on a number of paths, either simultaneously or one after another, as the various folds of our nature open up in the course of yoga. We have also discussed that the first door open to us, living as we do in this field of experience, is one of sacrifice. Sacrifice, not in the usual term of self-immolation, but in the sense of self-consecration. And this sacrifice covers the whole of life. It is a sacrifice of works, a sacrifice of our love and emotions, a sacrifice of knowledge. And when we mean by sacrifice, we have also seen that we don't mean only the external aspect of the matter, not the outer ritual, not the outer act of dedication, but more the spirit within, the inner movement that backs up the outer act. When we speak of the sacrifice of works, it means not only the external activity, but all that goes on within us, on the several levels of our being, the doings of the thought energy, the streamings of the emotional energies, the several formulations of the will within us before they are transcribed in outer action. So the sacrifice of Sri Aurobindo's conception embraces the whole becoming of man at every level, at every moment, the pouring of energies outward and inner is to be orientated towards the divine. Not in the beginning alone, but from moment to moment, the dedication has to be affirmed, organized, and confirmed. If all the activities of our life are to be thus converted into offering in the sacrifice to God, are we to include the day-to-day activities, insignificant as they look, inconsequential as they seem? The older traditions all over the world demarcated these activities as secular and religious. Those which don't pertain to the soul endeavor, to the effort of the soul in its attempt to unite itself with God. Those that should be severely left out, those that could be ignored, and those alone which are to be taken up and paid attention to. Naturally, in our system, this clear-cut divorce between the secular and the spiritual is not permissible. For the divine is manifest in all the spheres of life, and the whole of life is our field. It is not a beyond elsewhere that is the proper field of the spirit. But particularly the earth here, which is the self-chosen field of the Lord. That being the starting premise, it is incumbent upon every seeker to embrace the whole of his life in his effort. Whether these activities are directly connected with the spiritual effort or not, at any rate, whether they seem to touch it or not, they have to be uplifted. All activities of life are to be taken up, informed with the guiding spirit, uplifted into a new dimension, and invested with a fresh significance. This being so, it is out of question to follow the old injunction of the scripture that only those activities which can be made a part of our religious or spiritual life are to be taken up, and the rest gradually eliminated from us. This door of escape is not open to us. The seeker of the integral yoga looks upon all activities as movements of a spirit embodied in matter. All have their claim. All have to be cherished in the same spirit. As the mother once said, whether you polish the floor of a kitchen or perform a piece of surgery, the attention required, the outpouring of your energies, the dedication of the best in you has to be brought forward and consecrated to the Divine. It is not the act itself, but it is the spirit that infuses it, the attitude behind the doing of it, that ultimately weighs in the spiritual scale of values. This said, it does not mean that we go on doing the works that we were doing till yesterday, till the end of our time. Works have to be continued, but not in the same spirit, and after a time, not even in the same form. The level of the works, the level of the activities, has to be gradually shifted upwards and inwards. The character of the work and the results show a change in the measure in which a new spirit, a new consciousness is brought forward for doing the work. If we continue to do the works that we are obliged to do anyway, with the same mental attitude, with the same spirit, mechanically, we continue to move in the age-old rounds of ignorance. For that purpose, it is necessary that our endeavor to shift our center of activity inwards and the center of our consciousness upward, that should continue simultaneously. With the opening of the being to the consciousness and the light that pours from above, and with the assured safety brought about by our contact with the inner soul, what we call the psychic being the other day, it is a safe journey. One has to open the daily routine, the program of activity, to the higher light. And each day one has to renew the dedication, submit the life activity to the higher light, and watch what changes take place in one's own consciousness, what changes take place in the external field, whether the conditions and the circumstances remain the same, get worse, what reactions it has in the people around you. These are the measures of one's progress. In practice, situated as we are, the seeker begins by offering all the actions to the Divine. In theory, there is a determination, there is a mental will, the ascent of the heart. All the actions are offered, and to the best of one's ability, they are treated to the higher and the inner influence. Gradually, as the being finds its poise in the deeper consciousness, certain activities naturally move away from the center of the being. Those activities which tend to weaken the aspiration, which tend to obstruct the flow of the higher consciousness, they recede, and for a time the seeker confines himself to those activities which nourish his growth, which provide a rich field for the openings affected in him. But that is only a temporary stopgap arrangement. The third stage is, as the higher consciousness gets stabilized, as the center of activity gets firmly established in the psychic center, the whole of life is gradually taken up and put in the context of the new consciousness. This is the general background of the yoga of sacrifice. We said that this yoga of sacrifice is to be applied by man in the three fields in which he is simultaneously active: the field of knowledge, the field of love, the field of works. Let us start today analyzing the content of the sacrifice of knowledge. We spoke in one of our meetings of the age-old distinction in India of human knowledge, of the outpourings of the mental seekings of knowledge in two divisions, the knowledge, higher knowledge, and the lower knowledge. As it is called in the Upanishads, the Paravidya and the Aparavidya. That means knowledge as approached from the lower end, the reality, seeking for the knowledge of the reality from the lower end, from the material end, and knowledge that is reveals itself from the higher end. The sciences, the various disciplines of knowledge, systems of thought that have been developed till now by the human mind. The Indian tradition speaks of as many as 64 branches of knowledge. they have been built by the evolving mind of man, probing into the surfaces of things, probing into the depths of oneself, to analyze the truth of nature, the truth of one's own being. But the guiding light, the guiding principle has been the mind. All these branches of knowledge constitute, so to say, the lower hemisphere of knowledge. But they are not removed from the spiritual endeavor of man. They are welcome to form the constituents of the yogic effort. If, however, in the arrogance of its logical superiority, in the vanity of its intellectual arrogance, the mind insists upon teaching these branches of the lower knowledge as the final arbiters of truth, there they go beyond their legitimate range. Sciences, arts, all these branches are valid in their own province. They seek to probe into the processes of nature, into so much of the reality as yields itself on the surface to the different aspects of the mind, different approaches of the mind. But they are all subservient to a knowledge that is greater than the mind, a knowledge from which the ancient text describes the speech and the mind fall back unattaining. These branches of knowledge, literature, poetry, art, the sciences, music, or architecture, all these are, they are so many windows on the reality that is manifested, but no more. Once one begins to lead the spiritual life of our conception, these subjects can be studied, may be studied, and some are impelled to study. But keeping this proviso in mind, that they are subsidiaries to a knowledge greater than the mind, a knowledge which can be received by the mind in its silence, which can be reflected by the mind in its purity, but it cannot be built by the laboring intelligence. That knowledge is to be received in the being, in the mind, by purification, by opening oneself to the ranges that open above the thinking mind, the ranges of the higher mind, the ranges of the still higher mental levels which are illuminated by the higher light, the ranges of intuition, the ranges of overmind, and even beyond the overmind, the realm of the Gnostic mind, the supramental consciousness. These ranges are to be opened, and knowledge and light from those ranges is to be received, integrated in oneself, harmonized with our experience at lower levels. Our experience and knowledge attained at the lower levels has to be corrected and set into its proper proportions under the pressure of the higher knowledge that descends. It is in this context that the sacrifice of knowledge has to be conducted. Nothing indeed is taboo, but everything has to be given its due value, but nothing more. It is a question as old as the ashram here. People have asked Sri Aurobindo and the mother, is it wrong to read novels? Is it wrong to read newspapers? Sri Aurobindo had no hesitation in answering to every one of these questions with one answer. It is not wrong to read anything, but it all depends upon the attitude with which you do it. You can read the Gita, you can read the Bible and remain the same unregenerate man without being influenced. You can read all journals, time, life, everything included, and yet keep your consciousness lit, aloof, progressing. You read it, take the gist of it, take what nourishes and what helps the growth of your consciousness at any level, and leave out the rest. The consciousness shall not be allowed to dwell on the undesirable aspects, on the unspiritual element of what is contained in a book or a paper. If you are not strong enough mentally to keep out the undesirable element, then you should not read it. You should confine yourself only to safe, the so-called safe literature. But a spiritual seeker of the integral reality is an intrepid adventurer, and it does not behove to shut off this or that literature from him simply because it may upset. One has to face the task. One has to read what comes, understand, reject what is not correct, but assimilate and benefit by what is offered to him. Very often, when certain books, certain journals are put in your hands unsought, it carries a message. It has a meaning at the moment for you. We have to see why it has come. And if we are not sufficiently strong to resist an unwelcome idea, an unholy association in a book, really, we are not fit to be the sadhaks of a yoga. The other day, a book was placed in my hands, a huge book of 600 pages on the seed of creation or something like that. The gentleman concerned told me that an inmate of Oroville has asked if he can read that book consistently with his being a disciple of Sri Aurobindo and the mother. The nature of the book is definitely mischievous. It is full of mixed knowledge, the kind of knowledge that was familiarized to the human mind in the last century by the Theosophists or a section of it, still being tried to be perpetrated by the followers of the Bailey school of thought. There is an element of truth, but 90% of it is imagination and vital mixture. So when I said that it is better not to confuse one's mind by reading this, the gentleman who had raised the question, he came all the way to me and questioned how, as a spiritual seeker, I could shut out some part of human experience which had been cultivated by an earnest mind from the attentions of a spiritual seeker. I had only one answer to give, that before you handle a book, you should have a discrimination to know what is to be taken and what is to be rejected. Very often, the reader does not know. If a person who knows puts you on guard and you are discriminating enough, there is absolutely no harm in reading that book. He was indeed satisfied. He said, this is something better. This principle, that in any book, in any writing, in any branch of knowledge, there is an element of truth, there is an element of error. There is no element of error in a knowledge which comes directly from the levels of the truth mind. But when something is taken possession of by the groping intelligence of the mind, when something is received even from above and immediately quoted by the thinking mind, there is a great and a definite possibility of error. This is to be kept in mind. The gentleman asked, when I pointed out, can I have the same proviso when I read the writings of Sri Aurobindo and the mother? I said, certainly. Sri Aurobindo and the mother never ask their teaching, their writings to be taken on trust. It is for each one to read and confirm it in one's own experience, and then only start. Initially, you start with the faith that mother and Sri Aurobindo know something more than you do. This is what I had occasion to tell to so many. Nobody asks you to accept mother and Sri Aurobindo as divine. Nobody asks you to say that what they have written is infallible truth. Nobody. But if you can accept a book written by a scientist, a physicist, or a doctor as something to start with, is something said upon a subject on which we do not know, that is enough. You start with the faith that here is something which I do not know. And if you are earnest, as you proceed, the faith will extend itself. The knowledge that is given in the books will produce certain effects, will enlarge your consciousness in a manner that the trust and the faith will gather. If there is a resistance, if there is a persistent hostility in you, it means that you are not for that truth. You are not ready for that truth. That truth is not meant for you. Some other line of truth is open to you. That is the truth of things. And incidentally, when you read the writings of Sri Aurobindo and the mother, as indeed all authentic spiritual literature, don't ever try to understand or grasp with the mind. Have a receptive condition and read. Sail with the writings. Don't try to understand. Don't look back which is the noun, which is the predicate. Just go along as you get identified with the writing. Something which is present in it leads you by the hand. It evokes a response in the heart. It instills a calm and a silence in the mind, and even after you stop reading it, the sense will awaken in you. The mother even said that when you read the writing written from an experience of a new truth, as you read, new cells form in the brain to assimilate and to hold that knowledge contained. It may reveal itself to your external being and consciousness much later, but you should keep the effort of reading. Do not try to understand. The understanding is to come here and not here. Try this with Savitri. Try this with the synthesis of yoga. People say that the first canto in the Savitri is difficult. It does not matter if you don't understand. I have yet to know, meet a man who can confidently say that he has understood everything of Savitri. But it helps you to get into the swing of the poem, of the adventure of the spirit, and by the time you arrive to the last line and you are ready for the second canto. But there must be a regularity in your study of spiritual literature. A fixed time has to be done, kept for reading it. Because once you make a fixed time, the guiding spirit is present at that time, hovering. You should make it a part of your sadhana to read these books as if to take in spiritual food. We take physical food at regular times. Similarly, the spiritual food also is to be taken in punctually at regular timing. This truth of regularity, Sri Aurobindo has pointed out, is related to the truth of a rhythm in things. In this God's manifestation, there is a rhythm. At every level there is a rhythm. And we have to catch the secret of that rhythm and respond in tune with that rhythm. There is a rhythm of time, there is a rhythm of consciousness, the rhythm of movements. We have to build up a rhythm which can vibrate in tune with the universal rhythms that are ever active in the atmosphere. Next time, we shall proceed with the sacrifice of love. Before going to the questions, I think we could deal with one query that I have received this morning. That is, when any special work like concreting is in progress in this sacred place, it has been the experience of most of us that a special spiritual force is set in motion by the mother and everyone feels its presence, feels inspired and energized by the force. Even one has visible experience of that force and one works much more than one's normal capacity. One works with enthusiasm, with elation. That is perfectly true. It has been the experience of most of us in the ashram all these decades. Whenever there is a special function, special work to be done, and mother's attention is drawn to it, she does release a certain emanation which presides over the spot, helping everyone, assisting everyone, every participant, in the mind, in the body, in the vital, in all ways for the execution of the work. But then the question is, why is it that just after that work is over, one feels hopelessly let down, one feels very tired and exhausted? A question like this had been posed by me to mother some 15 or 16 years ago. She said, when you begin to think or look at yourself, instead of being occupied with the work, the exhaustion and these things start. If after the concreting or other work is over, if you do not slacken and let the mind dwell upon your own self, but occupy yourself with some other work, I feel that this exhaustion is not likely to appear. There has to be a graded tapering off. One shall not stop from work the moment the actual program is over. One has to occupy oneself with something else and gradually lessen the tempo. Otherwise, there is this feeling of sudden exhaustion because there is nothing, there is no willingness to support the action of that force. In the synthesis which we are studying, there are very many references to the Vedas, the Upanishads, especially the Gita, and in the later portions, in the Yoga of Self-Perfection, you will on to the Tantra. I thought some kind of background could be given in doses to our friends here on Sri Aurobindo's study and evaluation of these scriptures and see in what way they provide support to this philosophy and yoga. Conveniently, I was asked last month to give a series of talks on four successive days next month at the All India Radio on Sri Aurobindo and the Veda, Sri Aurobindo and the Upanishads, the Gita and the Tantra. They are scheduled to be broadcast in the first week of next month. I do not expect that our friends here will have the facilities or the time or the convenience to tune in to them. So I thought, since it takes only 10 minutes, each time we could take up one subject and I could read out to you the paper that I have recorded already at the station. To begin with, Sri Aurobindo and the Veda. Sri Aurobindo's entry into the Veda was quite accidental. He was interested in knowing what support the hymns of the Veda give to the theories of modern Indologists regarding the invasion by the northern tribes of Aryans and their conquest of a Dravidian India. His approach was direct, purpose limited. He read the hymn straight without the aid of the commentators, and he was amazed to find in them a great body of luminous knowledge behind a facade of transparent imagery. He was also struck by the confirmation in the hymns of certain spiritual experiences he had been having in the course of his yoga sadhana. He had observed a certain sequence of deities entering into his inner life for a considerable time. This was in 1910-1913. And now, while studying the Veda, he found answering descriptions which led to identify the deities as Saraswati, Ila and Bharati, the goddesses of inspiration, revelation and vastness. The more he studied, the more he was struck by the parallel between the experience and the ideas of the authors of these Vedic hymns and those of the ancient mystics of Greece, Egypt and the Mediterranean countries in the early period of their development. He found that to the rishis, the inspired authors of the litanies, life had two dimensions, the outer physical nature and looming behind and above the inner, subtler realm of unseen powers and presences. Let us call them the gods. The whole of external life is a symbol of a larger inner existence. Nature powers like sun, wind, rain represent the activities of the powers presiding over them, their respective gods. And he found further that all these gods are concrete powers and personalities of a supreme Godhead who is the highest, the one who multiplies thousandfold when he manifests all this universe out of his limitless being. In the life of these Aryans, and by Aryan no ethnological division is meant, an Aryan means he who strives upward, who aspires for the Godhead. In their society, sacrifice, yajna, is the central institution. Here again, the outer ritual of sacrifice is a figure, a symbol for the inner self-giving, self-consecration by man to the gods. Agni, the flame of aspiration, carries this offering of sacrifice to the gods of mind, gods of life energy, of purity, of love. The gods are Indra, Vayu, Varuna, Mitra, and they in turn pour down their riches to the sacrificer, the soul that gives itself to God. They come in to receive the distilled essence of his life experience, the Soma, and so nourished, they grow in the sacrificer, lift him up beyond the zone of ignorance and darkness, into the realm of supernal light, the luminous world of the Truth Sun, of whom our physical sun is a symbol. The whole scheme, Sri Aurobindo explains in detail, is worked out in a system of parallelism in which the outer ritual and the surface meaning of the hymns forms the religion of the common laity. But behind the surface, there is the profound truth of the inner consecration and spiritual interchange between men and gods, understandable only to the initiated. Both the suppleness of language and the symbolic mentality of that early age facilitated this esoteric come exoteric religion. Sri Aurobindo does not claim that this spiritual interpretation of the Vedic hymns is the sole possible meaning. The Veda yields different meanings to different levels of understanding, and that is so because it embodies in its thought the spiritual truth of existence. And this truth is many-sided. It has been understood in purely physical terms, in ritualistic setting, in astrological and medical or historical and legendary contexts. All may be valid from their respective standpoints, but the core of the Veda is the spiritual. That alone gives complete coherence to the whole body of hymns and makes it relevant even to the man of today. And so studied, the Veda reveals itself to be the book of knowledge. Sri Aurobindo has rendered in English almost all the hymns to Agni, the mystic flame, in the Rig Veda, and illustratively translated with justifying commentary many hymns to the other deities. Listen to a passage describing the advent of Ushas, the dawn. Dawn of luminous journey, dawn, queen of truth, large with the truth, how wide is the gleam from her rosy limbs. Dawn divine, who brings with her the heaven of light. Her the seers adore with their thoughts. This is she who has the vision, and she awakens man and makes his path easy to travel and walk in his front. How large is her chariot, how vast and all-pervading the goddess, how she brings the light in front of the day. This is she who yokes her cows of rosy light. Her journey does not fail, and such is the treasure she makes that it passes not away. She hews out our paths to happiness. Divine is she, far shining her glory. Many the hymns that rise to her. She brings with her every boon. Or the celebrated hymn of creation. Then existence was not, nor non-existence. The mid-world was not, nor the ether, nor what is beyond. What covered all? Where was it? In whose refuge? What was that ocean dense and deep? Death was not, nor immortality, nor the knowledge of day and light. That one lived without breath by his self-law. There was nothing else or what beyond it. In the beginning, darkness was hidden by darkness. All this was an ocean of inconscience. When universal being was concealed by fragmentation, then by the greatness of its energy, that one was born. That moved at first as desire within, which was the primal seed of mind. The seers of truth discovered the building of being in non-being by will in the heart. And by the thought, their ray was extended horizontally. But what was there below? What was there above? There were casters of the sea. There were greatnesses. There was the self-law below. There was will above.
There is a set relationship, for instance, between the effort of the sadhak and the working of the divine and the presence of the divine, the way Mother works with us and so on. A set relationship. I have a feeling that being here at Natsimundir and in this time in our view, that this relationship is a bit different. As if in general, in the interval yoga, we can go quite far, we can work with our consciousness, we can open and stuff. Well, now forces and powers are released, I am feeling, which work differently, the relationships are different. For instance, just one example that you gave now, about working in a certain rhythm, reading in a certain rhythm. That doesn't work here because we have concreting tonight and then we work full day and then we work for 3 days and then it just doesn't work. We have no rhythm. All these things are different here and now.
No, I didn't mean rhythm in work. It was rhythm in study.
Yeah,
there has to be rhythm in meditation. There has to be rhythm in study. But when such work comes, there has to be a certain self-regulation. Always a collective progress in a collective endeavor like this. Priority has to be given for collective needs over individual needs. That's one. Second, in spiritual life, people are brought and given the precise circumstances and conditions which are most relevant to their needs. A particular class of beings were sent and given their chance when the ashram formed. Ashram. A different set of souls, beings have come later and a different field has been given to them. It has a meaning. We have to take it that it is a chosen field given to us. Necessarily, in endeavors like this, there can't be regular hours of work, even in the ashram, where the life is regulated to the minute. There have been occasions when overnight people have had to work, people have had to go harvesting and all kinds of things during the last so many decades we have been seeing. The needs are sudden, and the rhythm, adjustment of rhythm is not so much external as inner. There has to be an inner harmony when we work in concreting, but the mind continues to dwell on something which you are used to do it at that moment. Maybe meditation, maybe concentration, maybe study. Even the thought is enough. This is the time I read Savitri. That is enough. The subliminal being takes care of it. The presiding angel over that communion of yours with Savitri, that acts on the subliminal. If you forget that, there is no occasion. But even a thought is enough. We have necessarily to modify our individual programs to suit the general setup. And I have no doubt whatever that the work for seekers who are gathered here is of a different type. And their way is different than the goal that was set before the set of people who came 30, 40 years ago to the ashram. There is no question of saying easier or difficult. The type of souls itself is different. We have no, I at any rate, I do not have the vision to look into the past lives and see who have advanced more or who have advanced less. It is not that. They have come for a particular kind of work. You all resume where you left behind, where you left in the last embodiment. I am deliberately mentioning this because there is a feeling, a wrong feeling, that work in the ashram or life in the ashram is preferable to life here. And in the ashram there are some people who feel that life in Auroville is freer, easier and preferable. But the truth is, spiritual life is the same. The way to be trodden depends upon each individual. This particular way is suited for those who are meant to walk on that, not for everybody. There may be people who are more energetic, who can work more. They may not be brought here. Those who are to embody that force of consciousness which is to build the hope of the future, they are brought here. Not all possibly. Some may be eliminated, some may go, new ones will come. But they are being given a chance to participate. It is the divine who has brought them. If man rejects that chance, chooses to go back, it is his loss. There is a meaning in some being kept there, some being brought here. It is not by accident, that I can assure you. Mother has said so many times that in her scheme there is nothing left to chance. Everything has a meaning. She does not move unless she gets an inner sign. And we have seen that where we have not left the mother free to decide things, but have imposed our preferences, our petitions and prayers in favor of so and so, and where she has yielded, all right, try, things have never been successful. And after years of observation and experience, we have now learned that invariably her first reaction is the correct and the right. And what she decides is the best for the individual. So when she says, you are for Auroville, it means that is the thing. If that gentleman pleads and she says, all right, you can come, it's a compromise. Any other questions?
Mm-hmm. Said there were 11 planets. Now, is that information or knowledge? Okay. And they're finding the tenth one now.
Finding the?
The tenth one, they're feeling the tenth one existed. But that's sort of...
If she, I do not remember where he has said, but since you say it is knowledge, To him it is knowledge, to us it is information. Reading aloud helps when the mind is too distracted, when either externally or internally there is too much of distraction. For a few moments to read aloud, it releases certain sound vibrations, physical sound vibrations, and creates, the necessary atmosphere of calm or peace. But if one is not distracted that way, even mentally if you read, the mental vibrations that are released, they are enough. If one is by nature extrovert, externally turned, loud reading helps. But if one is normally, one can be introspective, one can live to himself, then in the Indian Shastra, it is considered that soundless reading is more beneficial. For instance, in the Japa, they have three categories. The lowest category is the loud intoning of the mantra. The second, a little more advanced, is only the lips move, but nobody hears the sound. But still the person makes some physical movement. The third is that there is no movement, but the mantra goes on. Without moving the tongue, the words and the sounds go on. That is the third stage and the highest stage. These relate to different stages of development on the part of the speaker. Certainly, a book like Savitri, a few lines when you read aloud, they have a great, even therapeutic value. They impregnate the physical atmosphere with a peculiar spiritual vibration. And even on those around, they have a great spiritual impact. But for oneself, even a silent reading is enough. Otherwise, some people lose themselves in the sound and lose contact with the sense. Cyril, we meet next
August 2nd, and that will be the Ascent of Sacrifice 2, Works
yes.
of Love.
No, yes, the same Works chapter, the same chapter, Ascent,
yes.
Yes, Sacrifice of Love.
The Sacrifice of Love.